All right, so like there's a few people that are. Yikes. Looks like everybody is unmuted. Oh, I gotta mute. All right, everybody. I had done a little tweaking on the system. So looks like we're good to go. Starting a couple minutes late. We try to start every show. We missed a few shows because of getting everything together, but we'd like to start the show with a prayer to our Father in heaven. So let's go ahead and do that real quickly. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Well, welcome, everyone. Now, this is July 3rd, 2019. This is the day before Independence Day. And so I thought I'd read a couple paragraphs from the Declaration of Independence. I need to get some reading glasses at my age now. So here we go. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying in foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable, that to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. So I could go on, but I would encourage everyone to maybe read the Declaration of Independence in full. I know some radio stations and TV stations actually read the entire Declaration on the 4th of July. So we are going to proceed. Tonight we're going to talk about Social Security numbers, the collection of those numbers, the requirement or not requirement to even have one. And so I believe Larry was going to start off, followed by
Well,
Gary.
to provide a foundation for the discussion on Social Security numbers, which requires a discussion about the Constitutional Foundation. What is the Constitutional Foundation? There's a history behind it. And we've been over on this show once before, but I think it's well worth repeating. Joe, do you have those documents that I emailed to you?
Gosh, Larry.
There were three of them.
They don't happen to be on your website, do they?
Do what? No. Right before the show, say like maybe seven my time, which is an hour ago, I emailed to you three documents. But in lieu, I just wanted to see if you had them at the quick and ready.
Let me try to find them. I'll try to get them up here quick.
Okay. Well, let me know when you do. The Constitution, when it was drafted by the Philadelphia Convention, you know, resulted in and represented a kind of a compromise between the powers of the state and the powers of the federal government. You know, before the before that time, under the federal government as it existed under the Articles of Confederation, it virtually had no powers. You know, it had a power. It was a committee to try to persuade the states that had all of the power. By means of the United States Constitution, certain powers were surrendered from the states to the federal government. For example, before the Constitution became effective, you know, each state had the right to regulate the commerce within its own borders and the commerce that flowed across its borders. Well, that created problems. And because of those problems, you know, between the time of the Articles went into effect and all the way up until the 1787 Philadelphia Convention, you know, states had experienced, you know, troubles with not having some universal, you know, whole nationwide control over at least interstate commerce. So those are the things that the Philadelphia Convention decided, and all of the powers of Congress were delegated to Congress from the states by means of Article 1, Section 8. I'm presuming that a lot of our, yeah, that's one of them, Joe. You know, I just want to know that you had it handy. You can take it off the screen because it's going to be a while before I get to it.
Okay.
Nonetheless, I'll move on. You know, the Constitution set forth those 17 specific powers set forth in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And when you review those powers, you will see that there's nothing in there. And in fact, there was no thought back at the time of the Constitution that people would, quote, retire and the government would be involved in any retirement system for all the people. I mean, that was just completely out the window. Nobody had that in mind. And that's one of the reasons why it's obvious that it's not there. You know, nobody would have thought about it. And if it, if somebody had thought about it, it would be set forth as clear and express terms in Article 1, Section 8. So the 9th and 10th Amendments, you know, reserve powers to the states. So there was nothing delegated to Congress in the way of control over establishing some grand system for establishing a retirement system for a whole bunch of people in America by means of the United States Constitution, with the exception of the spending power. And this is something that the American people don't know much about. You know, when you sit down and you try to read cases, you know, what is the scope and breadth of the spending power of Congress? Well, it's, as the Supreme Court has noted, there are no limits to it. You know, there's, it's there, it's unlimited. And that's the reason why, you know, Congress can really come along and spend anything it wants, and it's going to be constitutional. Now, I would suggest to you that at least insofar as Americans inside America, inside the United States, you know, them getting benefits, you know, it would certainly fall within the scope of the spending power of Congress. But let's get straight to the point. In the early 1930s, you know, the international community was very, very interested in addressing a lot of the problems that had been created by World War One. You know, there was an international interest in declaring an end to world wars. Declaring an end to all wars. In fact, the Great War, which we now call World War One, was called the war to end all world wars. You know, so there were a lot of topics of interest at the international level, as there is today. Joe, I might want to ask you to pull up, you know, this is kind of moving forward into time instead of taking this in chronological order. Pull up the document I sent to you, UN Declaration of Human Rights. Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, I think you've got it as a PDF image, and you need to get rid of the sidebar that has the pages. Do you have Adobe Reader? Is that it? Yeah. Okay, that's, yeah, move it over a little bit more, yeah. Now look at the date of this. You know, the UN was created just after World War. You know, there was the League of Nations that was created as a result of World War One, and then after World War II was over with, we got the UN was created. And today everybody knows about the UN. But let's look at Here's a real problem I have with what goes on at the international level. Here you have this document from the, you know, the UN is a is an international body. It's not a governing body. I don't want it ever to become a governing body. But each country sends its representatives there, and they argue about international issues, and they try to create documents that relate to international issues. And here you have the Declaration of Human Rights, dated December of 1948. And when you sit out and you read these documents that come from the international community, particularly like the UN, you will find, you know, there's a lot of statements in there you could agree with. But when you pile them all together, you know, all of these rights that everybody has, you know, how would, you know, when you try to figure out what it would look like to exist in a society that they're talking about there, you know, it appears to be utopian. But the only way to be for it to be utopian would be for there to be some tyrannical government in place enforcing all of these quiet rights. But, you know, the thing I want to point out here, Joe, go down to, it may be Article 10. It's probably about page 3. Move on down. I highlighted it. I saved it with a highlight in yellow, so move on further down. I think it's in Article 10 of the next document. But move on down through there until you see something, maybe Article 25, maybe. Article 22, there we go. As early as 1948, here you have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This UN body is saying, you know, thinks that it's just great for everyone as a member of society to have the right to Social Security. Now, Joe, I think there's another little provision on the next page under Article 22. So just move down to the next page. Get you, just scroll down to, yeah, Article 25. Now, look at Article 25. Now, this has a relationship to Social Security. Well, it has a relationship to providing benefits. Everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, and other lack of livelihood and circumstances beyond his control. Wow, that would be so fantastic. Who's going to provide it? If everyone's going to be entitled to all of this, you know, the government that is going to provide all of these things to everybody will have to be tyrannical. But, you know, you can take a document like this and go through it and read the individual articles, you know, like you can see on the screen, Article 26. Everyone has a right to education. Education shall be free, at least in the elementary and fundamental stages. Wow. And, you know, there's a lot of things in here you say, oh, this is great, you know, all these various articles. But then when you start thinking about, well, how will this be accomplished and what would it be like to live in a society like that? You know, I think the thing that you're ultimately going to come to the conclusion of is, whoa, this would be, I don't think I'd want to live under such a government. Now, hey, Joe, while we're on this point of international agreements, get back out of this one. And there was one in 1976, the other treaty that I emailed to you. Can you pull it up on the screen? Now, here we have, you know, when Joe pulls it up, you will see that it's another one of those glorious documents. And you know, when you sit down and you start looking at these treaties, you know, there's a lot that you probably won't disagree with, you know, but when you try to see the big picture, you know, to me, it looks like this is the conclusion I reach when I look at, you know, having studied what's going on at the international level. You know, at the international level, they're really planning a whole lot of things. They want to build the government to control the entire world. Okay, that's it, Joe. Okay, go down. Now, this is the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Now, you can go through this document and read all the things. Everybody's got all these rights, you know. Well, all the libtards would go wild. Man, this just sounds great. You know, but what they're building at the international level is, you know, this is a document that will get people like the libtards, you know, in full agreement. Oh, we got to move for this. You know, the unthinking, uncritical folks that just will buy into anything. And here you see in Article 9, the states' parties to the present covenant recognize the right of everyone to Social Security and social, including social insurance. And you can see down there below in Article 10, adequate Social Security. Well, you know, everybody's going to agree with all of this. But, you know, what is happening at the international level is there is clearly a plan. And that plan is going to be involving having a world government eventually. And world government is going to be, people are going to be persuaded to support world government with documents like we had this treaty agreement on the screen. Oh, it's so fantastic. You know, we're going to bring in utopia. And you can see from these documents since the creation of the UN, one aspect of that utopia involves Social Security. And of course you can get over into other treaties. I'm not going to mention it here, but this stuff about the alien invasion that we're suffering from now, you know, the invasion from from Mexico. You look at those treaties and you know, what the libtards, what the Democrats, what we saw last week during the Democratic debate, all those hands go up. That was the international community. That's what the international community wants. The international community wants to have no borders, wants the aliens to be able to go from one country to the next. When you move from one country to the next, you know, if you don't have a job when you get there, you're entitled to free housing, free health care, you know, everything you see here in this agreement, these agreements were shown on the screen tonight. That is what the international community is interested in. Exactly what we're seeing across the world right now. Now, Joe, let's back out of this document. And let me just kind of return to where I was back at the end of, before we got into these documents. You know, in the early 30s, you know, as an aside, I will mention there was a big interest in controlling warfare and controlling arms. And that has been an interest at the international level for a long time, controlling arms.
IRS.
Okay. But in the early 30s, there was a lot of interest. You know, that's the origin of that's the time frame in which the international community got interested in Social Security. So Uncle Sam, you know, Uncle Sam has its ears inside the international community. He listens to what's going on there. And quite often, there will be an effort from Uncle Sam to send a message to the international community. Well, I maintain that's exactly the reason why the gun control laws in the early 30s were passed. But it's also the reason why in 1934, Congress came out and passed the Railroad Retirement Act. In 1934, Congress established a Social Security scheme for the workers of the railroads and, you know, other related interstate concerns. Well, the railroads didn't like that. And so they filed a lawsuit, and that lawsuit went to the United States Supreme Court. And in May 1935, in the Alton Railway case, the Supreme Court ruled Congress doesn't have these, you know, of course it would benefit interstate commerce if the workers in that interstate commerce were provided with free health care, free food, free clothing, you know, free this, free that, and the other. But then the Supreme Court said these powers lie outside the orbit of congressional powers. So in May 1935, the United States Supreme Court ruled. Now remember, Congress's broadest power is to control interstate commerce. I mean, there's so much that's just piled on Congress's power to control interstate commerce. Well, here they come along and pass a Social Security scheme applicable to, you know, a big part of interstate commerce at that time. And the Supreme Court in May 1935 comes along and says, whoops, This is unconstitutional. Now, our present Social Security laws were enacted in August 1935. And as best I can tell, you know, I'm just a country boy. My one leg is shorter than the other because I grew up on siding on the standing on the sides of these Appalachian Mountains. You know, if I'd grown up in Shreveport, Louisiana, I wouldn't have had that problem. Is that right, Gary?
I reckon.
So, you know, us old country boys, you know, the count from May 1935 to August 1935, to us, that's about 3 months. And also look at the United States Constitution. There was no constitutional amendment enacted during that period of time. But Congress comes along in August of 1935 and enacts the second round of Social Security legislation. And Gary, wouldn't it be fair to say that the second round of Social Security legislation wasn't limited to interstate commerce? It's broader than that. Am I missing something?
No, I think they just went hog wild the second time. And Larry, is it true that President Roosevelt issued the Social Security Act in essence through executive order before it became law?
Well, there were some things. I've read some things on that line. Have you got some particular point you want to bring up?
Well, it was Congress didn't even have anything to do with it. You know, it was almost as if he was throwing that treaty around, making the treaty the law through executive order. But the Congress got around to, you know, passing it.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. Well, in any event, you know, the second, you can say that the second Social Security Act appears to be broader than the first. Well, doesn't that raise some real problems? Well, just like the first time around, there were constitutional challenges made to the second round of Social Security legislation. And in 1937, the early part of 1937, you know, the Supreme Court comes along and has to address all these cases where the parties are sitting there scratching their heads, raising in the briefs presented to the Supreme Court. Hey, look, you know, in May 1935, in the Alton Railway case, you said thus and such. You know, and now we've got a far broader law, and, you know, so Congress has got, so the Supreme Court's got to do something with, well, gee, you know, in May 1935, you know, we held it unconstitutional. And, of course, in the interim, you know, Roosevelt had packed the Supreme Court. You know, he tried to bring in some justices that would try to uphold the National Industrial Recovery Act, you know, the things that happened during the Roosevelt years. And so what the Supreme Court did in this second round of Helfrich against Davis, Stewart Machine is an Alabama company. It's still down there on I-59 in Birmingham. You can drive along I-59 and see it on the kind of the northeast side of I-59. But, you know, the Supreme Court came along and upheld the second round of Social Security, the far broader Social Security Act. Now, Gary, you know, this is you answered this question last time. You know, I think it's in Stewart Machine. And if our listeners, the people that are participating in this call, want to read about this in detail, you can go over to my website. Now, my website, you know, is not Larry Beacraft. The legal material is not on LarryBeacraft.org. The legal material is over on a website that I put up on my internet service provider, Highway, back in 1997. And it became so congested, it was dangerous to move it. So I've left it there. So the way you'll find the Dixieland Law Journal is to type in Dixieland Law Journal into an internet search engine. Don't use Google. Don't use the CIA. Use Start Page. Or you can use the search term of Beacraft Briefs. Now, when you get over there to the front page of the Dixieland Law Journal, go down to, you know, I think it's at the top of the page, you know, a link to another page, jurisdiction. Now, when you get over into jurisdiction, you know, there's another link to another page dealing with treaties. And it's real important. You know, I think it's real important for the American people, the people that are interested in patriotic issues, to devote a little time each week, at least 30 minutes, maybe an hour, but a couple hours would be great. If we had more people that are educated about these legal issues, our movement would be far more effective. And I certainly do think that, you know, there's a lot of people in the freedom movement need to know a little something about the treaty power of Congress, because there's a lot of things that come at us that we dislike. It's being exercised by the federal government When you sit down and you take a look at it cold and hard, you'll find out that there's an international foundation. There's going to be possibly a treaty behind it. And, you know, hey, a lot of people don't like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. A lot of people don't like the Endangered Species Act and stuff like that. I think if you read that brief over on my website about treaties, you'll find that, there's an international basis for that. But nonetheless, you know, these cases I'm talking about are going to be found in my treaty memo, the Hovering Against Davis and Stewart Machine. And when you really sit there and take a look at, the Supreme Court in May 1935 held in the Alton Railway case, that this is unconstitutional. And the parties in Stewart Machine and Hovering Against Davis are arguing about the constitutional application. Where in the world did the Supreme Court address the arguments of the parties? And, I've isolated it, Joe, click on federal jurisdiction. Come down, federal jurisdiction is right below where you had the cursor a minute ago.
Right here?
Come down, and now treaties and jurisdiction, not right down below that. That's what you would click on. Now go back to treaties, that's federal jurisdiction. Click back, Joe. Okay, there you go. Yeah. Now go halfway through this document. Going further down. And go on down until you see Hovering Against Davis or Stewart Machine. And it'll be about halfway through this. And I would encourage our listeners, those that are participating in tonight's call, to, just take the time to periodically investigate some good legal information that has a relationship to increasing your knowledge about how governments operate. And, I've got a lot of that type of material posted over here on my website. Here you can see we're talking about radios. Oh, boy, it's real clear that Congress's control over telecommunications is treaty-based. Okay, now here's the Railroad Retirement Board against Alton Railway. Now, that's the Supreme Court case where it says, these powers lie outside the orbit of congressional powers. But now, go what's on the screen? Go bring that up at the very bottom. Bring it up to maybe about center screen, Joe. Come up a little bit more.
Where the highlights are, the hyperlink.
Yeah. Now, here in the Davis case, this is a question. I looked through Hovering Against Davis, the Supreme Court decision justifying second round of Social Security legislation. I looked through there. I've got the briefs. Well, where is this argument addressed by the Supreme Court that the parties raised? The implications of the Alton Railway case in May 1935. There's only one paragraph in that opinion, and this is my view. There's only one paragraph in that opinion where that is addressed. An argument of the parties. And so here's the way the Supreme Court addressed we're going to justify the second round of Social Security legislation that's broader than the first that we found to be unconstitutional. So we got to, pull something's real slick here. So this is the way they did it. Rather than pointing out the argument and address it, they just vaguely respond to it with a single paragraph. And that single paragraph says, when such contention comes here, we naturally require showing that by no reasonable possibility can the challenged legislation fall within the wide range of discretion permitted by Congress. Now, look at the case. This is what I say, when you have string cites like this in opinion, the cases themselves will be telling you something. And
big time.
Look at what the Supreme Court cites. The first case they cite for this amazing proposition is United States against Butler, which found a part of the National Industrial Recovery Act unconstitutional. Cincinnati Soap is the second case they cite. Gary, what in the world is Cincinnati Soap?
I think that would be the instance where they were importing coconut oil from the Philippines, so it's foreign trade.
Right. And that dealt with the validity, constitutional validity of that tax.
And Butler,
what I call the power of the federal government to deal with taxation in the instant of possessions. That's what I call a Cincinnati soap case.
Yeah.
And then the head money cases. What is the head money cases about, Gary?
That was that tax that was put on the head, the capitation. That's a 50 cents to get off the boat for a non-resident alien coming to the United States.
Right.
And if I just throw something in about Butler, that was also the Agricultural Adjustment Act.
Triple A program. Right. NIRA, National Industrial Recovery Act. Yeah. So here, you know, there's a message. There's a message in this one sentence of the Supreme Court. And the message is, well, gee, these cases that they cite, you know, what's this insular possessions connection? And gee, what's this aliens coming into the country connection?
Yeah.
You know, and of course, Congress has, in the insular possessions, Congress has complete plenary power. I mean, it is the sovereign in the insular possessions. But then also here in the United States, Congress is sovereign over the admission of aliens in this country, at least until recent times when, you know, Congress wants to bring in lots of taxpayers. But we know that these taxpayers are not going to be paying taxes. Hey, Gary, wouldn't it be fair to say that these people that are coming up from south of the border, one broad classification that they clearly fall into is they are taxpayers. Am I correct?
Absolutely. Non-residents.
So,
crosses
the Rio Grande, swims across the Rio Grande and enters into Texas. He may be an illegal alien, but for sure he's a taxpayer, right?
Indeed.
Okay.
Hey, I'd like to throw in there too, you know, the United States versus Realty Company. I believe that was the sugar, because, you know, the foreign countries that were competing with America for sugar back in those days, you know, was very, very important. And that sugar subsidy was that Realty case. And that was foreign trade.
Yeah.
It's equalizing foreign trade.
Good. So we have a real problem. Now, here's one of the things you have to deal with in reference to Social Security. You know, it's been pounded into the heads of the American people by the media and the government. And if you pile up all the cases dealing with Social Security, you know, just pile them into a big old law library, you know, you'd have a huge pile of cases there. If you would pull out of that stack of papers the cases that deal with constitutional basis for Social Security, it'd be a handful. It'd be 10 cases at most deal with anything about the constitutional issues regarding Social Security. A couple of them would be mine regarding the Social Security number and the driver's license. But, you know, we don't have, you know, the American people just accept, and this is one of the things that the federal government is good at, you know, taking a very limited field of legislation, you know, something that has a limited application, and by brainwashing, by media efforts, by propaganda, make it appear to be broader than it really is. And that's one of the things I think about Social Security. You know, it appears to be broader than it really is. And because you have a federal government that is operating outside of its inherent field, you know, the sovereignty, power, and jurisdiction of the United States is primarily external to this country. You know, it's the states that have the internal powers. It's the states that have the greater ability to control stuff that could, and resolve problems at the local level. But when the federal government comes along, which primarily has external powers, and it, you know, enacts legislation for an external power, but makes it appear to be broader than it really is, and confuses the populace into thinking that this legislation applies everywhere, then we have monumental problems. And I think we're going to be seeing some of these monumental problems. Now, hey, Joe, you know, I went home and I left my watch, and the Zoom program is covering up the clock on my computer, so I don't see the time. I don't know what time it is right now. Can you tell me that?
35 minutes after the hour.
Okay. Well, and pull up that other document that I got, and then I'm going to turn it over to Gary and Sean. It's that form to get a taxpayer identification number. It's real interesting. You know, to get a, you know, there's two types of numbers that are used, and we've been talking about the basis for one of the numbers. There it is. A lot of people have never, you know, a lot of people, oh, I need an employer identification number. Oh, they go over on the internet and fill it out. Oh, you can get it. And they never even look at the form. Well, a lot of people want to get a TIN. And, you know, the TINs are mentioned more than Social Security numbers and a lot of federal laws. You know, this, you know, they talk about TIN. And then the government wants to come along and say, oh, well, you know, when we refer to TIN, you know, we also mean included in that's the Social Security number. But here on the screen is the form W-7. This is what? The application for an IRS individual taxpayer identification number. And right under that, I bolded it in yellow. What does it say, Sean?
Or used by individuals who are not U.S. citizens or permanent residents.
So a citizen or a resident, they are excluded from getting a taxpayer, T-I-N, taxpayer identification number. So, Joe, I'm going to cease running my mouth right now. You know, I've talked about the Constitution Foundation for Social Security, and I think Sean needs to say some things as well as Gary.
Gary's up.
Well, y'all, give Larry a hand there. That was fantastic, Larry. The Social Security program. The Social Security business is driven over in Subtitle C of the code, where the employment taxes are. And if you think all the ball juggling that the Congress and the Treasury Department has done with respect to these finely worded sections, get over to Title 26, United States Code, and it's in the employment taxes under the Part 31 regulations. And I would say it's good to just jot this down because it will kind of get lengthy. It's 31, and then there's a period. I always say 31 dot, but it's 31 dot, 3121. And it's B in parentheses, little b in parentheses, dash 3. And that little regulation right there deals with the term employment within the United States after 1954. So taking that one little section dealing with services performed after 1954 within the United States will constitute employment. And what I would like to draw everybody's attention to, because this is what will ultimately reduce it to, is, you know, when Larry was talking about this Social Security application, it's only for foreigners coming to the United States. But here's a situation under 31.3121B-3, employment services performed after 1954. You go down to subsection C, which is little c in parentheses. It says services performed outside the United States. In general, except as provided in paragraphs C2 and C3 of this section, services performed outside the United States do not constitute employment. And then what they're talking about is if they're employed on an American vessel. But you go to 31.3121B3C3, and you see that the only people that could be only citizens that could be subject to this employment tax have to be outside the United States. So like we hear in discussions from time to time, you know, citizens within the United States, I mean, citizens outside the United States, foreigners doing business within the United States. This is a plain admission in the employment tax reg 31.3121B3C3 telling us that the only way that a citizen of the United States can be engaged in employment after 1954 is citizen is outside the United States. So,
well, Mr. Gary.
Yes, sir.
What about individual?
Well, you know, it's glad you asked that, Larry.
Me too.
Individuals.
Hey, gonna stop you right there. Go over to, it's also on my website, but then you can get it if you order Joe's CD that I prepared for him that he's making available for $20 or $25. And that has the regulations for the first Social Security scheme. Now, you know, when you take a look at regulations, they have to be drafted and they're interpreted just like statutes are. So when we're dealing with tax statutes, okay, hey, Joe, keep going back a little bit more. Go back. Yeah. Okay. Go down to taxation. Click on taxation. It's a little, okay. Is it pulling up taxation? Okay. All right. Now hit old tax action regulations up at the top. Now, this is on that CD that you can get from Joe, and it's a lot easier to have it on your hard drive than to deal with all the stuff that's posted on the internet. But I just wanted to show you, and I'm not going to, I'm going to see if our listeners will actually do something. But Joe, go down to the Social Security regs. The first Social Security regs are posted on this page or linked from this page. Go down and keep on going down toward the bottom. It's a little bit beyond halfway through these, is my recollection. Keep on going down. That's tax stuff. Okay. Maybe I don't know whether it's.
Is it this here, or you'll see it in just a second? You're a little bit of a lag. Regulation number.
Okay, yeah. There it is, down at the bottom, 90 and 91. There it is. Okay. Now I'm just going to tell our listeners this: you can get it from Joe, or you can pull it off this website. Take a look at 90 and 91, and remember, you know, tax statutes are construed most strongly in favor of the citizen against the government. In case of doubt, you construe it in favor of the citizen. So that converted into something in plain English. You know, go through this set of regulations and see where it is crystal clear who these regulations apply to. What do they apply to? And there is a section in this set of regulations dealing with this Social Security issue. And you know, that statement of who it applies to still exists today.
Individuals.
Yeah, they are individuals. That's true, Gary. You know, you're saying too much. Okay, I've said what I wanted to say, Gary. I interrupted you unfairly.
That's no problem. I appreciate that because it gave me an opportunity. Because, you know, years ago, anybody recognize this?
CDs.
Larry B. Crash.
Yeah.
I put this together back in the Truth Attack days, and I had some extras. If anybody wants, they just email your address. I'll mail them to you. But they're like collector's items. We can put them on eBay. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway. But nevertheless, we get back over here to this, you know, the employment taxes are very, very crafty because they use that word employee and employer very liberally. and, you know, the taxation. And, you know, I run the risk of being over the top confusing about income tax. If you just look at, if you just guys, you know, what's on the screen, you see subchapter C, employment taxes and collection of income tax at source. And so we're in subtitle C, which is part 31 regs. Here you are looking at the collection of income taxes at the source. These are little clues that the tax movement and tax protesters, and I call them cliff jumpers. If you're, you know, somebody just jumps off a cliff, they're going to grab a branch on the way down, and it's going to be, you know, the yellow fringe on the flag or whatever the issue of the day is. But the long and the short of it is, here we are in the employment taxes, and here these employment taxes are telling us to look at this part dealing with the collection of income tax at the source. At the source, the source they're talking about is going to be either two places, either inside the United States or outside the United States. This particular regulation deals with income source within the United States would constitute employment after 1954. So they're obviously talking about these employment taxes dealing with the collection of income tax at the source. Who would that be? The only character that I could think of, because they already told us in 31.3121B3C3 that it can only be a citizen outside the country. And if you go down to 31.3121L, Joe, this will give us the tie into what Larry was talking about, Social Security. And so the 31.3121L deals with an American employer, which would be classified as a wholly owned foreign subsidiary of a domestic corporation. And if that's not a mouthful, I don't know what is.
Gary, give it to me again. I'll search for it.
Okay, so you're down at the first hit there is 26 CFR 31.3121B3.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking for 26 CFR 31.3121L as in Larry.
L in parentheses, like that?
Yes.
I'm finding a V and an S, but not L.
Well, nonetheless, it deals with what constitutes employment in terms of Social Security. You're at K.
Looking for K if I can get to L that way.
But the language in 31.3121L is really interesting. And I think it's worth maybe 20 or 30 seconds to scroll down to get it.
I guess that's only going to give me
If you go back up the top, you'll be able to click next.
Okay. K2. Hopefully there's not 50 Ks.
Wouldn't be a surprise.
There we go.
So if in order, as I understand it, and you're welcome to correct me if I'm mistaken, but 31.3121L-1 is talking about agreements entered into by a domestic corporation. Picture a company like, everybody's familiar with FedEx. Let's just pick FedEx. Agreements entered into by FedEx with respect to foreign subsidiaries. In order for FedEx to be able to participate in Social Security certain services performed outside the United States now by citizens of the United States, FedEx would have to say buy, there's a company in, let's just make up a company that's equivalent to FedEx in the United Kingdom. Let's call it Package Express. And FedEx purchased Package Express of UK, and thus that Package Express UK became a wholly owned foreign subsidiary of FedEx.